is the New York State AFERD podcast entitled A through Z Health and PE. We are your co-hosts, Drs. C and C, the true Pan-American connection. I am Clancy Seymour, and my tag team partner is the one and only Dr. Victor Ramsey.
Details highlighting our episodes, guests, contact information, publications, and other useful resources will always be included in the podcast show notes. For more information about New York State AFERD, please visit newyorkstateaferd.org or Facebook and social media handles at New York State AFERD. Let's embrace the journey, and now, on to our show.
Greetings, listeners. I'm Dr. Clancy Seymour with my co-host, Dr. Victor Ramsey. Doc, how are you today?
I am doing well. Always a pleasure to be here. Always spending time. You know, weather is one of the things that I always bring back all the way from Brooklyn. It's a little rainy out there, but the temperature is just right. And to all the veterans out there, I'm a veteran as well. We wish you happy Veterans Day.
Indeed. Well said. And for our podcast listeners, today is November 11th, 2022. And so it is Veterans Day in the United States, Remembrance Day in other countries like Canada, of course, and the UK and around the world. And we have a special guest from the UK today. We'll talk more about that in a second. But certainly we have to always honor our history and pay tribute to our troops and our veterans from around the world. Indeed. Well said. So welcome to the New York State AFERD A through Z Health and PE podcast. In this episode, we'll be discussing a book entitled Models-Based Practice in Physical Education, written by world-renowned physical education scholars, Dr. Ash Casey and Dr. David Kirk. We are very fortunate to have Dr. Casey join us from across the pond in the United Kingdom for today's show. Dr. Ash Casey is a senior lecturer in pedagogy at Loughborough University. His research focuses on models-based practice, teacher learning and research, and the new use of technologies in learning. Ash is an associate editor of the peer-reviewed journal Physical Education and Sport Pedagogy, and is the co-author, and editor of four Routledge books, while continuing to publish regularly in leading education research journals. He is active on social media, where he writes and blogs about models-based practice, teacher learning, and new technologies. You can also connect with Dr. Casey directly on Twitter at Dr. Ash Casey. Dr. Casey, thank you for joining us today. And please say hi to our listeners, our panel, and of course, the illustrious members of the New York State AFERD professional community.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here from dark England at the moment. It's 5 p.m. in the evening. But it's a pleasure to be here on a Friday evening. I think I should get you to introduce me more often. Now, that's a good clue, because I've got a stutter, so I'm now going to put that out there. So if I do stutter, nobody will feel embarrassed about it, and I certainly won't, so we'll be great from there.
No worries at all, Ash. And, of course, welcome. And in the past, you were typically on the other side of the table of these sessions.
Yeah, I've led a few podcasts in the past, and they're really great ways to connect. But to me, I'd like to say thanks to the students for inviting me and being here, because, you know, you're the next generation, and you're the ones who are, you know, challenging the spaces in which you work. So it's fantastic that you're here, and I look forward to talking to you.
Couldn't say it any better. So I would be remiss if I did not also mention Ash's efforts with his own podcast, which he referred to in blog, Physical Education Practitioner Research Network, PEPRIN for short. Both are among the health and PE profession's most popular resources, not only in the US, but around the world. Congratulations, Ash. Your vision and dedication is an inspiration for us all. Your education record is truly impressive.
Yes, great stuff. So in addition to Dr. Casey, we have invited current graduate students who are taking a curriculum course with Dr. Seymour at Canisius College here in New York. Dr. Casey and Dr. Kirk's book, Model-Based Practice in Physical Education, is a required textbook for the class. I plan to do the same very soon. Lakisa, Stephen, Kepler, Michael, Jesse, and Andrew, times two. Welcome to New York State AFERD podcast. Graduate students in this class will ask Dr. Casey a series of questions that they'll be hopefully get this to discuss regarding the book. And so let's begin. Let's jump right in. So Andrew Romano, would you please ask your question?
So Dr. Ramsey, it doesn't look like Andrew is present for the podcast today. So we're going to have Dr. Casey just share us a little bit about the genesis of this book, how it got started.
Yes, sounds great.
Oh, God. Right. Well, I guess it goes back quite a long time. So I started teaching in 1996 and was quite a traditional practitioner, taught in a very, what I would now recognize as a very traditional way. And 7 years into my career, for reasons I won't explain, but they were really good, I decided to do a master's degree. I did a master's degree at Loughborough University. And I was very fortunate to have a stellar group of lecturers. If I listed David Kirk and Kathy Armour and John Evans and Dawn Penny and Laura Azzurri-Rito and Joe Harris and Lorraine Kale, and the list goes on in terms of figures who were influential in the field. And in that, I did some school-based research, and that's when I first came across a pedagogical model, smart education. You try to use that in the first instant, which didn't work very well because my head of department didn't connect with it particularly. Then cooperative learning, that rolled in from a master's to a PhD, and my PhD supervisor was David Kirk. And that kind of evolved into my practice, and I moved into higher education. And so I guess from about summer of 2003, when I first used sport education, all the way through to write this book, was kind of an apprenticeship of using models in schools and then teaching young teachers how to use them and then challenging the spaces around what model looked like. So the book was kind of it was something that David and I talked about. It was David's idea original, but he came to me. We were kind of talking around spaces in terms of what is models-based practice. And I guess the term is a little bit confused in the field. So you get model-based instruction and model-based practice, and then you get models-based practice, and you've got all these different ways of thinking about it. And sometimes it means an instructional or curriculum or pedagogical approach, singular. Sometimes it looks at the use of multiple models in a curriculum. And that was the aspiration that David and I had around what, trying to sort of settle down what the term meant, so that models-based practice means a curriculum approach to that uses different models to answer different questions and within a curriculum. And we moved away from the capital M and capital B, which because models-based is one word, the hyphen connects them together. So models-based is the real key here, so that the curriculum approach in a school is models-based. And we wanted to kind of synergize the large amount of research was out there and look at the similarities between different conceptions and kind of bring them together. And hopefully that's what we've done.
Awesome. Awesome. So Kepler Jean, you up? Yes, how are you, sir?
I had a question regarding, I know this is a very common model, the multi-activity and sports techniques curriculum, and why it continues to prevail in K-12 to this day.
Looks like Kepler froze on us, but yeah, he's asking Dr. Casey about how both him and Dr. Kirk refer to multi-activity or sport techniques and its dominant role in K-12 PE programs around the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and I think some of it's just to do with... We got the question, I think, Kepler. Dr. Seymour helped out, so I think you froze a bit there. Yeah, I mean, I've had a lot of privilege of working with teachers and departments, and I guess when I go and talk to them about curriculum change... The first question is well, what can we do different? How can this be different? And I think we have a situation where the physical education that we see a lot of is the familiar physical education. It's what we experienced at school. Now, I went to school in the 1980s, and I experienced a similar curriculum. And I'm now teaching teachers. So if I kept teaching the same thing, then we'd end up with a replication of that approach. So some of it is familiarity, I think. We know what we're doing. We know what physical education looks like. But I guess the problem with that is so does the media. And when you see portrayals of physical education in the media, they're based upon those people's experiences as well. So that's one of the first things. But I don't think it's only that. The timetable is quite restrictive. So when you have a short period of time within a school time, within a school curriculum where you move from place to place, that becomes quite constraining in itself. So physical education is being asked to operate in a very specific period of time. So what you can achieve in that period of time is can be limited. So the analogies we've used before is that it takes, I think I could probably walk 100 meters in just over a minute. And yet we do track and field, and we try to teach the skills and techniques, at least in the UK, of track and field, and they're quite isolated. And then other games, I guess the closest analogy between cricket, which is what I play, is baseball, which can take a lot of hours to play, and it's very stop-start. But the way of then teaching it is to teach those individual skills. So those techniques become quite easy units with which to show development and progression. Then you've got resource. If you're turning up with 100 kids in a class and you haven't got a huge amount of space or resource, it becomes easier to play small-sided games, or actually, in some cases, quite large-sided games, and get the kids to almost entertain themselves, I guess, because you're talking about limited spaces, you're talking about poor equipment, you're talking about, you know, underinvestment in PE as well. So there are some big problems that PE faces in terms of its status, in terms of its pedagogies, in terms of its resourcing. And it's very difficult to address all of those. But that continuity in practice becomes, you know, I guess easier to do, if that makes sense. And I guess the challenges and the way I started was to just change one class. So to just think, okay, so, and when I started, I just chose, I guess, easy classes. So I wasn't looking for, I was looking to challenge myself pedagogically, but I wasn't necessarily looking for the most difficult class to do that with. Until a friend of mine turned around to me and said, why are you giving your best teaching to your best classes? Why are you not trying to do them with your more challenging classes? And that's when I kind of came across the realization that what I'm already trying with them isn't working. So it's not, if I do something different, it's not going to be any worse than it is at the moment. And actually, it might be a lot better. And so when I started to do it with those classes that I guess were more challenging, it wasn't easy, but changing the way that happened was a really positive thing. And I guess it's taking those small steps. So when I talk to people about changing the curriculum, I'm working with a school at the moment, and their original idea was to change their entire curriculum to a models-based approach. And I said, you don't do that, you'll fail. Within the first 3 or 4 months, you won't be able to do it. It's too much work. So we peddled it back, and they started just with one year group, but they changed it. And then this year, that year group's moved up, and they're working with that year group and the year group that's coming below. So over a period of 5 years, they're hoping to change their curriculum over time. So it just takes, it's that process of, okay, I want to do this, but I need to think about an investment here. It's not a quick fix.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure I answered the whole question.
Yeah, no.
I may have gone off on a tangent, but
yeah, reasonable goals for sure. 100%. 100%.
Yes. That strategy of the best teaching with worst class was just awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Best teaching with your worst class. I like that.
For sure.
Strategy.
So our next student is Lakeisha. And Lakeisha, I'd ask you to say hi to Dr. Casey and ask your question, and maybe introduce yourself. Tell us about, or tell Dr. Casey where you teach or what you're currently doing related to the PE profession as well.
Hi there, Dr. Casey. Thank you for being here with us. Yes, my name is Lakeisha. I am a physical education teacher. I teach at an all-girls private school in New York City, a Catholic school, Convent of the Sacred Heart. And my question for you is, what is models-based practice in PE? Is it a new concept? Please explain, and have we made progress regarding using it?
Well, I mean, the first time the kind of notion of models-based was used was probably in the 1970s. Models was used, you know, there to start to talk about PE curriculum. And I guess it's been used in lots of different ways. Some of the early pedagogical models curriculum models, instructional models were developed in the 1980s, for education, 82, teaching games for understanding, 84, maybe even 82, I'm trying to remember. But yeah, so there's kind of that, these things have been around, cooperative learning was developed originally in the kind of 1960s, 70s. So the actual approaches have been around for a while, Keisha, but I guess what's happened is that they've been a little bit, so they've been seen as innovations. So these are new ways of teaching and they're all sparkly and shiny. But, you know, to come back to Kepler's question, they haven't got past that kind of dominant, you know, sports technique based approaches. But over time, more and more people have used them. It's kind of like the, you know, it's kind of like that, the butterfly effect, I guess. So that might be what I'm trying to think of, a way of doing it, where there's a little bit of stuff coming through and more people are doing it, and they're talking about it and they're discussing it and they're writing about it and they're researching it. And we're coming up to this point where it's, in my experience, is becoming more and more popular in teacher education courses. So academics are buying into it. More teachers are beginning to do it. You see it more in the professional journals. Those, you know, the across the world, I've seen them in the Australian Journal. I've seen them in Jopurd and in P Matters over here. So they're beginning to gain kind of traction. And they're certainly within the vocabulary now, and more people are trying them. Sport education is probably the most commonly talked about model. Lots of people use that. TTPSR, teaching personal social responsibility, cooperative learning, teaching games from understanding, and other kind of game-centered approaches are all developing. So I think there is we're reaching a more critical mass. I'm not sure we're at a critical mass yet. I think that it needs to develop more, Lakeisha, in terms of how we're understanding how it happens. And more people just almost need to take a plunge. So it's, okay, I want to do this. I'm going to do it slowly. I like something. I want to give it a go. And I want to be prepared to fail. I think one of the things I see a lot in when people try new things is they don't necessarily give it enough time and they don't give themselves enough chance to get better. So a term I've used quite a lot is, when I'm learning to teach in a new way, my students are learning to learn in a new way. So when you change the way that you teach, it's very unfamiliar to young people. So if they've gone through physical education as the receiver of knowledge, and they're doing that in maths and English and science, and suddenly you're asking them to be producers of knowledge and kind of co-participants, they don't understand the rules. So people try these things and they don't work the first time, and they go, this is much harder than teaching the way I used to teach, which is to tell the kids what to do. It's, again, comes back to Kepler's question. Sorry, my stutter's coming in here. And it's that connection. The reason that we have this is because we're comfortable with it and we know how it works. And we know the right responses to make in given situations. So we feel comfortable, even if it's not working. And I guess the challenge here is to be prepared to feel uncomfortable, but give yourself to become, so you have to gain a new expertise. This is why trying to do multiple different approaches at one time is quite hard. So my advice is to do kind of one and then two and then three and then four, or maybe two and then three. So you can kind of choose. So I guess they've been around for a while. They're much more talked about and used now. And just the more people give it a go and then tell us how it went. That's what we need. Teachers, I don't know if you found this, but I found that teachers want somebody else to tell them that it works because they've tried it in their classroom. So when teachers are talking about models and using models, whether it in podcasts or listening or whether it's at conferences or whether it's in school districts, then I think we'll start to see that critical mass develop more and more and more. Did that answer the question?
That was awesome. And, you know, it reminds me of the conversation.
Thank you.
I had, Dr. Casey, about becoming fluent, right? Learning a new language speaks to that. The models approach, it's a new language. It's a new...
Yeah, I mean, the term I've used before is pedagogical fluency.
Yes.
So when I used to teach, this was probably 2005, 2006, had a colleague of mine who was a French teacher, and she was a French national. She'd come across the channel, and she was... She was fluent. I mean, flawless. Slight accent, but her English was flawless. And I said to her, "Well, Laurence, when did you know you were fluent?" And she said, "When I started to think in English." Mm-hmm. And to me, pedagogical fluency is when I started to think in the model I was using. So I knew what the response was. Not the response was when I was telling students what to do, but the response I needed to make when I was using cooperative learning, what the next step was. Until then, I needed a phrase book. I needed to remind myself, okay, that's the way I would respond, but this is the way I want to respond. And I remember I'd spent a lot of time trying to use a teacher-centered approach, and I've told this story before, but I was using a cooperative learning approach into track and field, and there was a group doing relay, and I walked across the field and I walked up to them and said, "No, you," and I stopped. And I was like, "Okay, so," and I was like, "I'm sorry, you're supposed," yeah, "so I've told you that this is wrong, which I shouldn't have done, but can you tell me how to make some changes to what you're doing?" And that was a real seminal moment to me. And that was a learning experience in myself to kind of know when to give guidance. And I think that's important. The more you understand how this works, the better. But you've got to give yourself a chance to get it wrong, as you've got to give kids a chance to get it wrong.
Absolutely. Too. That residual teaching or coaching, right, that we've talked about as well. It happens to me a lot where I catch myself and I have to subdue the residual, you know, to be comfortable with the new approach. So this segues nice to our next question. Our next question comes from Andrew Spinelli. And Andrew, introduce yourself to Dr. Ramsey. Tell him a little bit about yourself and fire away.
Hi, Dr. Casey. It's a pleasure talking with you. So I am a health and phys ed teacher in Staten Island at Tottenville High School. And during the fall and winter, I coach boys basketball. And during the spring, I coach girls flag football. So I get a little bit of everything. What I'm going through now kind of resorts to what you spoke about before in terms of resources. So we have about 4,300 kids in our school. And each phys ed class has about 200 kids going at a time. So we have limited space. We have all of the material that we need. We have everything that you can imagine, but space becomes an issue. So we were doing a volleyball lesson actually yesterday, and we had to modify it because the way that we were doing it, kids were on top of each other on different groups and different sections. So it was a little frustrating because, you know, when you have volleyballs flying all over the gymnasium, it, you know, gets frustrating. It's obviously a hazard to everyone. So, you know, so I definitely thought that what you were saying before in terms of resources related to me, because we have basically three gyms, and each of them are filled with 100 to 200 kids each. And, we use outside as much as we possibly can. We use the athletic fields, but you know, when it gets colder out, it's tough to use that. So, our resources become an issue during the school year.
How many teachers do you have in a set? So if you've got 200 children, how many bodies do you have? How many colleagues do you have to work with?
So it's 50 to one. So we have four classes going at a time in each side. So we have the main gymnasium, which the boys head over to. That's four classes as well, 50 to one. And then we have two separate gyms for the girls on the other side. And that's also 50 to one, but we have a partition splitting both gyms in half, just to kind of, which actually you would think would help, but it actually limits our space even more. So it's definitely a struggle, but I mean, you know, this is what comes with the job. It's thinking on your feet and saying, how can I make this better in this situation? Maybe this isn't working. Let's switch over to that.
So is that, are we talking basketball court cut in half size? Are we talking smaller?
So it's a smaller court, but it's full size lengthwise, but not widthwise. So you get it going baseline to baseline, but sideline to sideline is probably maybe like 25 feet wide, if that. So, okay. You know, we get as much as we possibly can. So like I said, we were doing that volleyball lesson the other day, and we had our groups and circles doing bumping drills. And we realized that, you know, if one mishandled a bump, it was going completely into a different group. And so we ended up having to modify it. But yeah, I just wanted to reflect on what you were saying about, you know, resources and stuff like that.
I guess my question would be, why volleyball? So I guess what are you trying to get out of those lessons? Is that a state decision around certain games?
So we always, in my school, we always start with a fitness unit because so we're in high school. So we start with the fitness unit because at that point in this age group, 14 to 17, everyone's getting into different styles of whether it be, you know, weightlifting or CrossFit and all that stuff. So we introduce things like that. We go over dynamic stretching, static stretching, what the difference is. And different body movements and components that we find are important. So we switched over to volleyball just because that was one of the things that we got the best feedback from, which I actually wrote in our last reflection paper in our class, because it had to do with meaningful phys ed. So we figured that if we get the most interest, this would be, everyone would want to play. And if people see their friends playing, they may want to jump in and just to be with their friends and socialize and have fun.
And do you think they're doing that with the large sizes, or is it?
Yes and no. Sometimes it could be a little bit intimidating, especially for the newcomers, the freshman group. It definitely gets a little intimidating because you walk into a gym and there's just 200 people all in different spots, and it's a little intimidating at first. But once you overcome that, I think you know, us as teachers lead the way that, you know, we try to get everybody motivated to have fun and just, you know, use this time to get out of the classroom and have a little fun with their friends and socialize and get away from the books and all that.
It sounds incredibly challenging, and hats off to you.
Thank you. And my question to you was, the term pedagogical model is used a lot in the book to replace curriculum and instructional models. Could you explain that a little bit further?
Yeah.
Is that more specifically the term pedagogue or pedagogy?
Yeah. So
I believe that's the question, right, Andrew?
Yeah. I understand the question. So we've talked a lot about instructional models. And instruction to me is a teacher thing. It's a telling thing, and I guess from it comes from the teacher. The curriculum tends to be, you know, a wider thing. And I guess understanding what pedagogy is. So the original word pedagogue is a Greek word. It was actually a name for a person who used to travel with a student to school. Actually, normally a slave. In ancient Greek times, but they used to literally, their job was to look after the needs of the young person. So moving away from the connotations of kind of being a slave, the actual job of that person was to facilitate the learning of that young person. So to get them to school safely, to help them engage in those processes. So pedagogy is a broader notion than just curriculum and instruction. So the way that we use it in the book is it's teaching, learning, curriculum, and assessment. And those pedagogical choices are made in those different areas. So if we're saying that the teaching or the instruction is part of pedagogy and curriculum is part of pedagogy, then we're looking at a broader notion. So that was one of the ideas, was to try to think about that these choices are not just about what the teacher does or what the curriculum looks like, but it's that kind of multifaceted approach where we're looking at how assessment aligns with curriculum, aligns with the needs of the learner, and aligns with the teaching. Now, often, to come back to Kepler's question, the teacher is dominant. So in that kind of multi-skills approach, the teacher is making the choices and the teacher is dominant. And that's a comfortable place to be in if you have any challenging pupils, or you're in a situation where you feel that you need authority. So when you give autonomy and authority to pupils, then that is a risk. You're taking that risk. So to be in that space, in that instructional space, can feel more comfortable, which is why giving little bits of responsibility away, either with a class or with a small group, is a good way of kind of seeing that, how the kids react to that change in their environment. But the way you assess that is important. So if you're using a teaching gains for understanding approach, you need to assess understanding. Now, understanding is different to skill. So often we go, so we see a situation where somebody, I don't know, somebody tries a 3-point shot, yeah, and they miss it. And we just say it was wrong. But if they're capable of making a 3-point shot and they were in the right position to do that and the game was in the right situation for that shot to be taken, then it's not wrong. But that's decision-making as opposed to skill execution. So if they show the understanding that they're in space, they're capable of making the shot, and it's the right thing to do, then why do they get told that it's the wrong thing to do? Because they didn't get the skill correctly. So by talking about pedagogical as approach, you start to look a little bit wider about the knowledge that is valued. So knowledge in games is not just about being able to execute a skill. It's being able to manipulate the field position. It's being able to manipulate the ball. It's being able to manipulate the opposition to get into the right position. If you can do that, but you don't get it right, that's more than half the battle. That's absolutely what we want kids to do. But we don't reward that. Because they miss the shot, and I've seen it done in long jump in schools. They run in to do long jump, they don't hit the board, and they just say no jump. And all the flight in the air and the kick and the reach and the landing and everything is lovely. But because they miss the board, everything else after the jump becomes void. And I guess the pedagogical notion is, how do you look at things beyond the actual situation and the actual skill? And that's why we're kind of trying to look at that broader term, because physical education has to be more than just physical skill execution. Because the kid who takes the shot in practice and misses is the kid who in the game makes the shot and hits it, because they're in the right position and they understand it. So they have to be able to fail, but failure isn't wrong. It's that development. So that's why we looked at the notion of pedagogical, Andrew, instead of just looking, you know, kind of within that instructional space or that curriculum space. But it was also to have a common way of talking about it. So if we talk about everything about a pedagogical model and we talk about everything as models-based practice, then it helps globally to begin to think about these terms. So when I talk about them in the UK and then you talk about them in the US, and colleagues in Spain or colleagues in Brazil or Australia, we know what we're talking about. So we share that global community. And the joys of things like this podcast is that we can talk to many more people. But if we keep talking in slightly skewed language, it's much more difficult to understand.
Wow. This was incredible. I mean, in fact, I'm taking notes because it has me rethinking things that I can bring back to my future professionals. So thank you. That was awesome. We want to keep the momentum going. We have Stephen, but before Stephen come on, can I ask Kepler to introduce himself? Because we forgot to ask you to introduce yourself, my right. friend. Go ahead.
My bad. Right. So I currently work in a BOCES elementary school, K through 5. I've been currently subbing for about 2 years as a PE teacher. And a couple of things I noticed, especially with the pedagogy, like there's not much on like what I was mentioning before, like the multi-activity model. It's more just like, all right, here, basketball time, not much on specifics on what to do. And usually the kids there's always like one or maybe 2-3 kids that always end up getting upset because, you know, they lose. And maybe if there was more like team structure, things going on where it's not always like, you know, me versus you and I win, you lose, like type of things going on. So I think with all the models that exist, I think it's very good as an upcoming PE teacher myself to keep an open mind.
There's a great paper. I nearly mentioned it. I don't know if it was in Andrew's questions or Lakeisha's question, but there's a great paper called Darwinism in the Gym. And it was written by Mary O'Sullivan and brain's gone dead. Clive Pope, sorry, I knew I'd get there. And it was when they were both at Ohio State University, and they went to watch the gymnasium at lunchtime. There's a really interesting paper in terms of the dominance of certain, and you can imagine the elite male students dominating the basketball court. But it's a very interesting paper in that what you're kind of talking about there, Kepler, that kind of certain players dominating spaces, certain people dominating spaces. There's another example which we want to of Kathy Ennis's papers, which was Sport for Peace, where they changed the rules of the gym. They basically said that actually being the best person is not the way you succeed in this gym. Helping other people is the way you succeed in this gym. And that changed the dynamics a lot in terms of how that processes work. So I guess, Andrew, this might work in your questions. It's what do you value? So if you can get the kids to self-regulate, and what you value is not just performance, getting back to the pedagogy, then you can move away from what it is to be dominant is not to just be the best sports person.
Right.
That's phenomenal.
It's nice to meet you.
Yeah, no, it's phenomenal, Ash. And it speaks again to, unfortunately, some of our missteps in the past with PE and how we can make things better currently, right?
Right.
Yes. Steven, you're on.
Hello, everyone.
First, I just wanted to say thank you, Dr. Anthony, for your service. Thank you, Dr. Casey, for being here and talking with us. My question is in regards to the theory of practice architectures, in terms of using practice architectures as another term to help further explain pedagogical models. And could you kind of just explain the connection between the two concepts and how they kind of relate to each other and build off of each other?
Yeah, so I'm going to use the basic terms here. So in terms of practice architectures, the chemists and colleagues talk about the sayings, doings, and relating. And if we start with those things, so the sayings is what is said about PE. So again, we come back to the original question from Kepler. What is said about PE is that it has to be done in this particular way. This is what we recognize about it. This is how it is enacted. The sayings might say that in this school, we, again, Andrew said that he always started with fitness and then they move on to something else. Now, in some schools, the sayings are very, you know, this group, the elite group will always do the main sport. So you can imagine in the US that being basketball or that being football. In the UK, I taught in predominantly schools that focused on rugby or cricket. And those were the schools that people played. Those were the games that people played all the time. So that's what's said about it. And interestingly, when we've worked with schools who are making changes, the older kids who were in the school or were in the school saying, oh, so when are you doing football or have you done this? So, and parents are expecting. So the way that we talk about PE does a lot to construct it. So we got the saying, then we've got the doing. So what actually happens in that space? So you could talk about lots of constructs. So the hidden curriculum. So this is what we say we do, but this is what we actually do. So we say we're inclusive, but actually we exclude because we're only interested in certain bodies or we're only interested in certain mindsets, or we will teach this or we won't teach this. And some of that is about PE, and some of that's about, it could be about race, it could be about sexuality or gender. We're saying certain things in these, we're doing certain things in these spaces. So you've got these two kind of, you'd think complementary, but actually they often work, you know, against each other. This is what we say we're going to do, and this is what we value, but this is what we actually do. And then you've got the relatings, and the relatings are the way that those in almost around physical education have an influence over PE. So that could be your administrator who has did PE in the 1980s like I did, and has a very fixed state of what PE looks like. So when he walks into your lesson and he sees the multi-skilled activity approach, he or she feels comfortable because for them, that's what PE was. So, you know, and then you've got the state policymakers who are saying, well, in this state, you must do fitnogram or whatever it is, fitnessgram. And that is what physical education must look like. So when they don't see, when they see that, they go, oh, this is a good physical education lesson. And when they don't see that, they go, well, what are you doing? You do not know anything about PE. So, and then you've got, So in all those spaces, you've got what people say, what people do, and how people relate to physical education, and it's all in that space. So when you're making change, you have to be aware of those things. When I started in my classroom, that was my classroom, and I could do quite a lot of what I wanted to do. But as soon as I opened the door and walked out to the school and tried to do it, then it became difficult. I remember a conversation with a colleague of mine, a very dedicated colleague. She worked tirelessly, and I had a huge amount of respect for what she did. But she was her and I were polar opposites. I was trying to do what I thought I should do innovatively and changing, and she thought we should do things the same. And I asked to do something differently, and she said, Ashley, you haven't been in the school long enough to make changes like that. And my response was, I've been here for 10 years. How long do I have to be here before I can start to make changes? But that was to do with the way that things were done in the school. So, yeah, and I guess that's where we get in terms of that process. How did these things interact with each other, and how do we need to be aware of them when we start to make changes? And when we start to talk about the sayings, doings, and relatings in a model, then we're aware of what they are. So in cooperative learning, we want kids to learn together. We want them to be reliant on each other. That's what we say. But if we go into the classroom and all we value is technique, then we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. So what does it look like in action? And how does the narrative around it kind of create? So hopefully I answered your question a bit there, Stephen.
Yes. Thank you. Wow. And next up, we have Jesse Pfeiffer. All right, Jesse, introduce yourself.
Hi, everybody. It's nice to put a face to the name, Dr. Casey. So thanks for coming on with us today. I'm Jesse Pfeiffer. I'm actually a senior at Canisius College currently. I'm finishing up my undergrad degree in physical education and health, and I was lucky enough to join this graduate course because of Dr. Seymour. So thanks again to Dr. Seymour. And my question for you, kind of just discussing the final chapter of your book, you discuss the model-based practices and what's necessary for it to flourish in K-12 PE, as well as the structural challenges that multi-activity and sports techniques that are enabled in K-12 PE. So just if you could share with the rest of the class and the listeners at home, just a little bit more on those two prompts. Thank you.
Yeah, I've already talked about, the timetable is one of the things that we talk about in terms of those constraints. And this is a very difficult thing to change. So I was talking to colleagues at the university yesterday about what is valued in schools, and this kind of multi-activity program is very embedded in the whole school approach. So the way that we approach schooling tends to be what Hal Lawson described as the industrial school model, which is where at the age of it, Andrew was saying that Kay Keffler was saying he works in an elementary school. So they'll arrive in your school at the age of 4 or 5, Keffler, is that about right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So at 4 and 5, they're all ready to do what they have to do in that first year. And some of them will be 5 and some of them will have been 4 by a day when they walk into the school. And they're supposed to be ready to move through that approach. And then they go through their timetable and they move from teacher to teacher, or they move from subject to subject. And as soon as they turn 5 or 6, then they move on to the next level. And we move this conveyor belt. And people move through schools on this conveyor belt. And when they reach the age of 11, they're ready to do this. And when they reach the age of 18, they're ready to do this. And that's operated through the school timetable. So when the bell rings, everybody stops what they're thinking about. I dismiss the class. The bell doesn't dismiss the class. All those sorts of things that you see. But the reality is, when the bell rings, you've stopped doing what you're doing and you move to the next section, I guess. So the timetable is a difficult thing to do. It's a difficult thing to break down. And if PE is, in some cases, PE is the last thing to be timetabled, which is why you get situations that Andrew has where he has, 200 students in the same space. And that might just be the amount of people that you have, Andrew, I don't know. But it's also something to do with how you timetable PE. And sometimes they timetable it well. I've seen it in some schools where the 11-year-olds turn up at the same time as the 16-year-olds. And, they get changed in the same space. And the bodies that are in the space are very different. The maturity is very different. And then the school's supposed to try to teach that. So the timetable is quite a difficult thing. But we can begin to talk back to schools. So we can talk to administrators about, you're challenging me even more than you need to do what it is I need to do. So, you know, the timetable is different, but can we use the timetable? So when I talk about change, we talk about this A and B. And if you're at A and I'm at B, I can't expect you to come to me at B. I have to come to you and I have to bring you with me. Now, I want to be slightly ahead of you like a pacemaker and I want to be encouraging you to shift, but I can't expect people to make this big move. So could you change one thing in a timetable? Could you move one thing in a timetable? Or could you change the timetable so it's no longer about basketball and football and volleyball and fitness? And can you start to talk about other outcomes? So now we want cooperation and we want collaboration and we want game understanding and we want personal social responsibility and we want health understanding and we want activism and all sorts of, you know, all sorts of different outcomes. So those outcomes start to become educational as well as physical. It's across multiple domains. So those are some of the challenges. Some of the challenges are much bigger and they're beyond us, Jesse. These are conversations that the relators have to have. These are the conversations that people have to actually say, well, we've invested millions and millions of pounds in PE and it's not working the way it is. So I say pounds, I mean, billions of dollars in the US, or, you know, but it's not working. So what can we do differently? And people have to think differently. And that takes time. So I guess it's what are my easy gains and where can I kind of make changes and make developments and how can I A and B, how can I kind of come to B and move it forward? You know, how can I move that process forward a little bit? Some things you can't change, but you can, you know, you can advocate for change in your district, in your school, in your district, in your class. Now that might be easier if you're in a management position, not so easy if you're subbing and looking for, you know, a full-time job. So it's picking the battles that you can have. Because the number one thing is you need to look after yourself and you need to look after the kids in your care. And when there's a conflict, you are very important in that process. So, you know, thinking how you can best serve the young people you're working with and make those changes in order to kind of develop, you know, really important question to ask. But some of these things are challenging. And we talk about gymnasiums. We talk about, you know, what would be better? Would it be a gymnasium with no lines on the floor, a big basketball court, but with no lines on the floor? Because lines can be constraining. When you walk into a room or a big open space and it has two baskets hanging down the side and it has a set of markings on the floor, you say it's a basketball court, but it doesn't have to be a basketball court. So it's imagining spaces in different ways as well. So, but we do it on a timetable. You are timetable to be in the basketball court. You are timetable to be on the football field. You are, you know, on the athletics track, and we use them as destinations, but what they can constrain what happens in that space as well. So it's thinking about what you can achieve in a space that isn't determined by the space itself. Does that make sense?
Fascinating, Ash. And this is a really important question that Jesse asked, because in your final chapter, you and Dr. Kirk address it well. And in fact, I've heard both of you address this in other podcasts and other sessions. And the thing that I love about it is that, yes, we can do a lot as PE practitioners to change and get better. We always have to be reflective and thinking about multi-activity and its dominance and how we have to potentially become pedagogically fluent in another language or multiple languages in terms of models, plural, right? But I think the reason why this resonates with me is that Dr. Casey and Dr. Kirk don't just point the finger at the practitioners. They really eloquently explain that the timetable, the conditions that PE is currently under in the United States and around the world allow for multi-activity to flourish. So it's beyond the challenge of PE teachers. It's a structure that we have to also address.
And we can make decisions ourselves. We can sit in that structure, we can be comfortable in that structure, or we can challenge that structure in certain ways. Sometimes it's just little things.
Yeah.
And the little things, so there's a saying in the UK, look after the pennies and the pounds will look after themselves. So look after the cents and the dollars will look after themselves. And sometimes those little changes, the little ways that you're trying to work, make a huge amount of difference. you can have a huge difference in somebody's life without trying to, you know, to move away. I mean, we're not going to move. Andrew's not going to move away next week from the class sizes that he's got. And it's not going to happen. But what little changes can you make over time to improve those spaces? But the one thing P is not very good at is collecting evidence about itself. So one of the big criticisms of P is it doesn't say, we tried this and this happened, and here's the results of that. We use a lot of anecdotes.
Yeah.
There's lots of anecdotes. So PE teaches leadership and responsibility. Well, there is no empirical evidence to say that PE teaches, because A, no one's done the study, but B, you have to teach leadership. It's not an implicit outcome of something. So you can't just be in a team and learn cooperation, because we all know there are really selfish players.
Well stated. And what resonated with me during that whole explanation you gave there, Dr. Casey, was advocacy. You got to advocate for yourself and for your students and the ones that you're servicing. So on Anchor, we have Michael O'Rourke. How are you, Michael?
Hi there, everybody. First off, Dr. Ramsey, Dr. Seymour, thanks for having us on the pod today. Dr. Casey, thanks for joining us across the pond as well. First things first, to all the veterans out there, thank you for your service. Thank you for your sacrifice. Always means a lot. It's nice to take a day to recognize that as well. For everybody out there, I'm Michael O'Rourke, and I am a middle school health education teacher. I work in a Gowanda Central School District. It's about an hour south of Buffalo, New York. I'm also working on a certification to become a nutritionist. I'm a mixed martial arts coach, and I'm also soon to be a youth hockey coach. So pretty much my whole life revolves around health and sport education. So although I'm not a PE teacher myself, I find a lot of value in the discussion we're having in the textbook and all of our, all the material we've been working through in this class. So my question for you, Dr. Casey, you know, you've been doing so much work with pedagogical models in K-12 PE. What's next for you? You know, thank you so much. And I'll mute up and I'll listen.
Yeah, so what one of the big findings out currently is that when universities work with teachers, as to use a term that Vicky Goodyear used, a paper was retweeted yesterday, and I went back to it, and we talked about this notion of a boundary spanner. So someone who comes from one context into another and creates a conduit that allows change to happen. And when that happens between universities and schools, then you see success in terms of pedagogical change. Which is great. But is it sustainable? Can we actually look at, you know, the question that Lakeisha asked was around, is it still an innovation? Well, it's going to remain an innovation if we have to get people from university to talk to every single school in order to make changes. So what I'm interested in at the moment is how have schools or teachers engaged with models-based practice? And how are they finding it themselves, and how are they engaging it? Because that to me is what we need to understand. Not necessarily how I do it with other schools, but how schools do it themselves. So what I'm really interested in now is kind of those experiences. And I'm working with a doctoral student who's looking at exactly at that. So he's going to talk to some schools in the UK who are saying that they're using a models-based approach, or are thinking of using a models-based approach, and begin to understand from them how they're actually accessing models, how they're using models, how it's applicable in their sites, and moving away from. I mean, one of the reasons in this book we moved away from. I use the term with Peter Hasty, model fidelity, and model fidelity was always intended, when Peter and I wrote the paper, to hold universities and scholars accountable for what they were talking about. So I saw sport education. There is no such thing as sport education. Sport education is not a thing. You can't just use sport education. You have to understand it. You have to adapt it. You have to use it differently in different contexts. So you can't just say I use sport education. It's not a proper noun as we've talked about it before. It's an action. It's a verb. It's a commitment to try to teach in a certain way over a period of time. It's that kind of promise to yourself and to the class that that's what we're going to try to do. Therefore, what happens in your class, Michael, is be different to what happens in Stephen's class or Kepler's class or Jess's class, because you're in different places. So if you're still sticking to the main idea of sport education, though, and you're looking at, you know, competent, literal and enthusiastic sports people as the main idea, and if you're trying to help them through roles other than that performer and festivity and competition and affiliation, then, you know, you're doing sport. But it won't be the same way as Lakeisha's doing it in her school, because it can't be. But how you do that and how you engage in that and how you understand what it is to do that is really important. And the more we understand about that, the more we can almost span more boundaries. Does that make sense? So we, by you understanding and then helping us to get that out to other people, the more other people can understand. And teachers want evidence. They want to know that it's worked in another school, not just because, you know, Dr. Ash says it'll work. That's really weird. I'm just Ash. I'm getting, you know, I know it's certainly not a UK thing. It's not just because I said it would work, but because other teachers have said it has worked as well. And you can kind of connect with the similarities that they've experienced. So that's the next step to me, is to remove the boundary spanner, to actually look at how people connect. Now, you've connected to this book through this grad class. But what will you do with that knowledge? What will you do with it tomorrow? And what will you do with it in 5 years' time? So if suddenly in 5 years' time, you haven't done anything with it because of the situation that you're in and you couldn't, and somebody suddenly mentions it to you again, then the knowledge you have now can hopefully act as a seed to be a catalyst to make that change. And it's so to me, when I'm talking to young teachers, it's not who you are today, it's who you want to be. And can you remember that? Can you remember that when you're in a gymnasium with 50 people on your own, 50 kids, Andrew, on your own? Can you remember that this is something you want to try to do when you're teaching in difficult circumstances? And that's not your, you didn't choose to put 50 kids in front of you. You might have wanted 20 kids in a bigger space. I'm sure you did, but that's the reality of where you're working. But how can you make those little changes? Maybe not today and maybe not next year, but just sometime when the opportunity arises, can you remember the type of teacher that you aspire to be? And that to me is really important. So when my last year of teacher ed students left, I got them to write them a postcard to themselves about the type of teacher that they wanted to be. Now, we didn't have time for me to then stick a stamp on and hold them for a year and send them to them. But that's what I'd really like to have done. And what I said is, go and put that away somewhere. When you discover it again in 5 years' time, then look at it and think about where you wanted to be today and where you are when you next read this piece of paper. And you might go, well, that was rubbish, and rip it up and throw it in the bin. But that's your choice. So I guess somewhere in that long spiel, Michael, I actually answered your question.
Well done, Ash. I love that idea, too. That's something I might borrow, if you don't mind.
I am going to, yes, immediately. Yeah. I'm going to try that. I love that.
You know, the thing that you bring up, Ash, that I think is important, that you talk about the cents will take care of the dollars, and, you know, the journey, the process, the little steps we must take. And again, another reason why this book really connects is that, you know, Dr. Ramsey, yourself, myself, we've been involved in research, and we appreciate and respect fidelity and the idea of, you know, complying and making sure that we have that that approach and that integrity with the interventions. I get that. But the thing that I loved about this book is that you make allowances for the ecology, the surroundings, right? And if in a certain district a PE teacher is applying sport ed or tactical games or TGFU or cooperative learning in their own unique way that makes it meaningful for those students, and yeah, maybe it doesn't look like where it would, where it'd be somewhere else, that's good. That's where we want to go, and we want to learn from that, right? And so not at the expense of fidelity, but just recognizing that, hey, that's the right direction we need to go with this.
Yeah, I mean, I've had the privilege of just finishing some work with a Norwegian academic who's 2 years out of his PhD, called Lars Bjorke. But Lars and I have just worked on a paper together looking at his PhD. And he found this, and I love it. But when we talk about fidelity to procedure, that's holding somebody accountable for doing things in a particular way. But he came across this paper by McNeil et al., which is fidelity to goals. And that fidelity to goals notion to me just made so much sense. So it's one of the big things you want to achieve. And how are you honest to those, and how do you stick to those? So that the main ideas of models-based practice, that, you know, that what we've talked about in the book as the learning aspirations. And we use the term aspirations very deliberately, because learning outcomes can tend to be, we want you to learn this and you learn this. Well, these are the aspirations for the lesson. But those aspirations, if they're kind of, these are the things I want to achieve in my teaching today, this week, this month, this year, that's much easier to hold ourselves. And these are my goals for this unit of work. These are my goals for this thing. And how am I achieving them? Is if my goals are to, you know, for kids to interact and cooperate more, then how do I recognize those, and how do I actually reward those? How do I see them? How many times do you see somebody stop a game to go, whoa, that's the best piece of cooperation I've ever seen? But what would it look like if you did?
Right.
What would it look like if you actually, I don't care where the ball goes, I don't care what you do. That is fantastic. That needs to be told to the entire class. Did you see that? Did you see that arm round somebody? Did you see that bit of comfort and support? Yeah. If we started to value those things, then kids would know what was more important. And it isn't, you know, that slam dunk. The slam dunk is a different thing. The slam dunk is giving up your own time to work with somebody else. Now, that's a goal you can buy into, but not if you're only interested in kind of skills output. So what goals do you have in your lesson? What goals?
Well, and again, I think your framework, main idea, critical elements, learning aspirations, plants that seed nicely to allow and inspire PE professionals to try it in their own way. I, you know, kudos to you. The book is phenomenal for that reason alone. I love it.
And local agency is really important. That's what we're talking about here. Giving teachers, Lakeisha is the expert in her school. She knows her kids. She knows who they are. She knows where they're coming from. And therefore, how can I, as a boundary spanner, go and tell Lakeisha how to teach? I can't. I remember I sent a paper when I was a teacher to JTPE, Journal of Teaching in PE. And somebody from 3,000 miles away in America decided to tell me that I was teaching wrong. And my response to that, tell me I can't write and I'm not an academic for Toffee, but don't come from 3,000 miles away and tell me I can't teach. And that was absolute fire in me. It was like that, you know, do not even try that.
Agreed.
You know, I can't teach Stephen to teach in his school. I can't teach Kefla to teach in his school. I can't do that. I can help and support, but I'm not that teacher. I don't know those people. And that's where some of this fidelity, it was never to hold teachers accountable.
Sure.
Well, teachers have challenges in ways that we don't know. And you know, what Michael experiences is different to what Jesse will experience when he goes out into practice. And they're not the same things.
Absolutely. Kudos to you and Dr. Kirk for recognizing that important balance. That's awesome. So on behalf of New York State AFERD, we'd like to thank Dr. Casey and our Canisius College graduate panelists for joining us today to share thoughts and perspectives. Really well done. To our listeners, especially physical educators and our future professionals, the information shared today can serve as a catalyst for ongoing preparation. This session will be posted on the New York State AFERD website and our podcast channel. Stay tuned for new and exciting episodes scheduled throughout the year. Vic?
Yes, please visit us at newyorkstate.org. Social media handles at New York State AFERD, or call us at 315-823-1015 for more information. Please also take note that our professional development events throughout this year, including our annual state conference at Turning Stone in Casino Verona, New York, next week from November 16th through the 19th. And thank you all for being part of our space and enjoying this time with you.
Thank you so much, everyone. That was
fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Thank you.